2024 Health, Human Services, and Housing Committee meeting to order. I will begin by entertaining an approval of the May 2nd minutes. Before I ask for a motion to approve, is there any discussion on the May 2nd minutes? All right, then I will take entertain a motion to approve of the May 2nd minutes. Moved by Legislator Collins, seconded by Legislator McCullough. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. We have a guest with us today. Prior to the last meeting, I circulated a presentation that was provided to the Law Enforcement Committee regarding the sheriff's opioid response as county law enforcement. And folks on this committee wanted to get some more information about that, so we asked Juanita to share with us the presentation, and so she's here, and we've got it all loaded up. So I'm going to move to the side, and if we can do like 5 minutes for the presentation, and then like 5 minutes for questions, is that?
5 minutes?
If you can keep it like for 10, we do have a full agenda.
Roll through it pretty
quick. We can, a lot of people have seen it already, so sounds great, and you can, I'll move to the side.
This
is the advancer.
Okay, great. Hello, everyone. My name is Juanita Hotchkiss, and I am the Director of Community Incarcerated Service with Ulster County Sheriff's Office. So I oversee all of the CIT teams and grants for our CIT teams and a lot of the programming that is occurring in the jail as well in partnership with the jail superintendent. So I'm going to share a little bit about some data that we've collected from the Oracle team. You've seen this data, but I'm going to add some context to it. So first of all, the Oracle team, so these are the services. We have CIT trained officers. Oracle is opioid response as county law enforcement. We have a social work who's also a substance use disorder specialist, two substance use disorder care managers, and 4 peer advocates. Basically, our core services is we have an overdose response team that follows up on every single overdose in the county. We have a community hotline, and we have an overdose prevention program, which includes outreach, naloxone distribution, and various harm reduction education. And we also have jail reentry services as part of this. And so our jail reentry services, primarily, this particular team serves individuals who are on the medication-assisted treatment program at the jail, but also pretty much will serve anyone who they encounter with substance use disorder as well. And so with that said, so these are, you know, some of the details about the various parts of the program. So this is basically, I think what is most important here, because this is where the presentation is coming from, is our overdose response program. It is a co-response. So basically, after an overdose, our team reaches out to individuals just to connect, say, hi, how are you? You know, we know that you had a situation last night. What can we do to help you? And meets them where they are, no matter where they are, okay? And helps them navigate to really to treatment, to, you know, to safety and harm reduction, whatever it is. But it's a very engaging role. So we also have a collaborative community response. We recognize that, you know, as we're engaging with folks, so is our community. They probably are already known to our system of care, and so we have the whole system of care looped in. So we have a meeting once a week where we do collaboratively work with other community organizations. You can see we have the Department of Mental Health, Mobile Mental Health, Hudson Valley Community Services, Independent Living, Catholic Charities. You know, so these are just a few. We have several organizations that are part of this collaborative. And so what have we learned? So we have what we call an OD map. And so all overdoses are indicated in this map. So anytime an overdose occurs, it gets logged, and we're able to do some surveillance, hot spotting. but we really weren't learning enough about the individual. It's just the frequency of overdose. So we had 519 total overdoses in 2023. And I will say that these numbers do and have changed, but for the purpose of this evaluation at this time, there was 519 that were evaluated. And so that's overdoses. So it could be the same person multiple times. But what we've learned from that is that there were actually 369 individuals. So out of that 519, 369 individuals. And we broke it down even further because we started to recognize that the nature of overdose is different for everyone. It could be intentional, it could be unintentional. And so I'm going to explain that just very simply. Just like the medical examiner determines the nature of an overdose, we have put a system in place to determine the nature of overdose internally using very similar criteria. We're one of the first, as far as I know, to have done this, but it's helped us understand our population and really create a response that is targeted. And so what you have seen in the past is you have seen our breakdown. So this is the criteria. When we say intentional, it is very specifically intentional, very specific that the individual had taken the substance with the intent of dying by suicide. That was the intent. We understand there's a spectrum of overdose. So there's individuals that fall in the middle, which perhaps is a place of hopelessness. And so this data does not capture that. So it's unintentional and intentional. And so here are some of the numbers. As you can see, we broke it down. One of the things that we learned is that the intentional overdoses occurred on very different months. We started to really see that this is a very, you know, the demographic was different, the timing was different. It actually falls in line with national statistics, but January is really with the time where we saw a lot more intentional overdose. And then we saw July and September were for unintentional. And so I'm not going to go through all this, but you've seen the areas. And I do want to mention the Central Southern community that is indicated here does not include Ellenville. Right, that is in the western part of the community, and we had to break it out like this for data suppression purposes. So with data suppression rules, we have to be really thoughtful and mindful because it can really indicate, you know, some areas are very small, and it can be really indicated of an individual. Yeah. When we weren't able to break this out, it looked like we were having a massive issue in the central and southern community, specific to overdose, unintentional. And when we broke it out, we were able to realize that there's a dual crisis on our hands here, and we must address it differently. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be putting Narcan out, naloxone. It just means that we also need to be paying attention to other things like mental health resources. And so I did continue to break it down, and I'm probably already over my time, Abe.
That's okay.
So I did break it down, and again, we were able to learn a very different demographic, and this, again, is in line with national statistics as well. Before we had this ability to connect individually with people, we were not able to see this big picture. We were not able to understand the demographics in this way. We were not able to make a targeted response. And so we started to even look at race, breaking it out. We see our unintentional versus intentional. Again, different demographic. I did put the numbers as well as the percentages because I know that's of interest to folks. What we are seeing in terms of data and trending, we are seeing, we're not seeing a necessarily disproportionate number of our BIPOC community overdosing in either way, but we are seeing a disproportionate growth. And so this is something that our team is taking, you know, very seriously. And again, we can slice and dice this, and it really does help us, you know, put out resources where it needs to be and put out people where they need to be when it comes to, you know, having a more mindful response. And so ethnicity as well. And again, we can look at the demographics We look at age. We're looking at a very younger demographic when it comes to intentional overdose. And then we're also seeing, when we pull this apart, we're seeing our unintentional non-fatal is really between the age of 25 and 34, and then 30. The next is 35 and 44. When we had all of these numbers together, I mean, it did look like we were seeing a jump in our 55 to 64 category, but what we're seeing is actually our intentional overdoses in that category, which really speaks to the importance of mental health care with our elder population and our aging population. So I did want to point that out. Overdose by substance, unintentional, still majority is considered, our opioids are primary in our the majority of our overdoses, but our intentional, other substances. And so what is other substances? It's non-classified substances. So these are substances that are not classified drugs. They could be over-the-counter, or so it's not a sedative, it's not a stimulant, it's not a classified drug. And so that is primarily what we're seeing is being utilized in our unintentional or our intentional overdoses, and largely. So what we learned from all of this is that we need to be able to differentiate, and we need to be able to look at the individuals in our community that are experiencing overdose or that experiencing any sort of disorder or crisis, and we need to be able to look at it individually. We need to be able to gather information if we really want to make a very specific and thoughtful and mindful community-oriented response. So throwing naloxone out everywhere was great. It's not going to hurt, but we also need to shift gears and make sure that we're also putting out our mental health care and our mental health treatment and destigmatizing mental health, especially in very specific certain areas of our communities where they might have a bit of a service desert, for sure. And so we actually just got a grant. We're going to be instituting a co-occurring team, capable team. So a mental health professional will be on our team. We call it our SAFE team, essentially doing the same thing as Oracle, going backwards in time, looking at the day before, seeing what happened, making sure that people were connected to services if they weren't. You know, sometimes they are on scene. Sometimes an officer does connect an individual to mobile mental health or Department of Mental Health or other services. Sometimes they're not. And so this team is going to be that stopgap to make sure that that is occurring, and also going to be available in these communities that, you know, where a co-occurring response was obviously very needed. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Any questions from folks in the committee? So I'm going to go with Legislator Collins and then Legislator Harvard.
A couple things. You talk about the number of overdoses. My belief is that you're only getting reported overdoses, correct? There could be a significant number of unreported overdoses.
Yeah, actually, good point. So I do want to say this first quarter of 2024, we are down in reported overdoses. So these are reported overdoses, which means that our efforts are actually working, and this is how we're interpreting this. If the less the EMS is called, we're not saying that overdoses aren't occurring, but we're saying that our community is more equipped to handle and manage and for individuals to stay alive without calling 911. They're able to connect with service providers. They are looped in to the system perhaps better. So that's one of the things that we derive from this. But we are down about 30 some odd percent the first quarter of 2024. So it is true. This is only reported.
And it could be because of what you said, which mm-hmm. is hopefully what it is, where they're getting services 100%. Outside of this. It could also be just that they don't want to talk to the sheriff, right? They don't want to call 911. Is that part of it too, or not so much?
I feel like when someone has an overdose, it's when you arm them with tools. And so our team is not uniformed.
I understand. Social workers. You guys do a great job. But it's still that stigma for some people about.
They don't need to call. They don't need to, because they're able to, to work with other community providers. They are likely already looped into our, you know, our Oracle team and are connected to our peers and are connected to other service providers in the community. We're a linkage program. Our job is to connect people to the providers out there. And we don't keep them, but we connect them and then we make sure to follow up so that we don't lose folks.
One follow-up question. Sorry. Unclassified drug, can you give an example of that? Because that was very mysterious to me.
So an unclassified drug would be anything. I mean, a NyQuil. It could be, a drug that is not a classified drug, not something they could buy. You could buy it over the counter. It could be Tylenol.
Non-opioid,
non-stimulant, non-benzoid.
Sedative? Like, wouldn't NyQuil be a sedative? Because that was a category there.
Yeah, like dextro, sedative, but it would be classified sedative. Is what we're looking what we're so that would be like xylazine is a sedative, so it's a classified drug. So it's non-classified drugs. Basically, we're seeing a lot more over-the-counter drugs are being used in our work when it comes to
for intentional.
Yeah.
Legislator Harmon.
Two questions. The first is, you said that there's an increase in number of overdoses in the BIPOC community over what period of time?
We were looking at, since I've started working, and analyzing this data with our data, with the data analyst, by the way, I don't do this myself. we have a data analyst that works for our Department of Health and really reviews and puts all of this together for us. We just give her the information. So it has, over the past, I would say, 4 years, we're looking at. So 4 years. In 2021 or 2022, when we looked at it, it had increased by 13%. So I don't have the exact percentage of what we're at now, but I believe it's up around 18.
Thank you. And also, what is, are there specific initiatives to kind of model this proactive behavior for and with law enforcement, mm-hmm. right? Like, do we have some sort of expansive program by which the sheriff's mm-hmm. deputies get mental health care on a regular basis, right? Like, are we doing the destigmatizing work?
Yes. So we have, like I said, the CIT team. So crisis intervention training is really critical to assisting and destigmatizing all of this. And so that is really our goal, is to get at least 50% of our participating agencies trained in CIT. So we're holding, I believe our next training is in September or October. I can't remember, it's somewhere in there. I'm looking to Tara, our commissioner. But we have a CIT training, and basically it brings in mental health professionals. It brings together, it's the intersections of care in our community, and our officers do attend. That's one thing that we do, and we have a lot of work that we're doing internally. I think just having these teams internally has really created, has really helped destigmatize mental health and substance use.
And that's great. Thank you. But I'm actually asking a different question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I wasn't clear. I'm asking how proactive we are in making sure that our law enforcement agents receive mental health care as a means of destigmatizing.
Okay. So we just, as you all know, because you approved it unanimously at the ledge, we're launching our officer wellness program that also falls under my division. I'm very excited about this. This is a huge part of destigmatizing mental health and substance use, because it starts here. This is where the work starts. And so this rollout is going to be not only for our sheriff's office, but for the entire first responder community, including our dispatchers who are truly on the front lines, who are receiving these phone calls. It's going to be for everyone. And no doubt that this is going to make an impact, no doubt. And so that is what we're doing.
Yeah, I'd love to hear how, you know, to get feedback about how that's going.
And we're going to be doing surveys, and we'll certainly, I'm big on collecting data to support and changing paths when we need to change paths as needed. But it's a peer-to-peer program, which is nationally recognized. We're utilizing as an evidence-based practice to roll this out. So we're very excited.
Thank you.
Great.
Out of all the cases, do you track the unhoused, or are they included within those numbers?
They are included within those numbers, but we can very specifically pull it out. I wouldn't have enough time to go through everything, but we can certainly pull that out because it is one of the data points that we look at.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One more question. So I think at the end you talked about just starting to backtrack what happened with the overdose, right? Are you looking at how they got to where they are? Meaning, did they just come from rehab? Are they part of a medically assisted treatment? Those kinds of things, because that's a question that we as policymakers need to kind of understand. How many of them go to rehab, come back, overdose? How many go to medically assisted treatment and overdose? Because if there's a difference there, that's going to influence how we set policy.
100%. So this is one way that we, so our group, our team that meets with our community of providers, we learn from each other. And we're trying to understand, you know, how we can better serve. And so everything we can possibly do in terms of understanding the individual and, you know, who are they working with, what was their experience, did they just come from rehab, we learn from each other. We have a universal consent form that is utilized as part of this group, so individuals can you know, really be triaged in terms of like what's the best service for them to be connected with. We work very closely with our Department of Mental Health, and we track this information. So, you know, we are looking at certain points, and so I would be able to tell you how many individuals who overdosed from the information we have were on medication for opioid use disorder that we were aware of, that were in treatment, or that were basically, or were receiving harm reduction from one of the service providers. We are able to separate that information as well. It's a lot though. So, I mean, you know, if you guys have a wish list, you're welcome to send it over, but it's certainly something that I would be willing to come back and share with you.
Yeah, why don't we talk about that? You know, outside of the meeting, and then if it's data that can be shared, that's helpful. If it's more a conversation, if it's a smaller meeting or whatever it is, you're also welcome to reach out, of course.
Yeah. You could always call me. Anyone in this room can always call. I'm happy to.
Thank you so much. So just to say, moving forward, and I'm glad Sue's coming on board, is next year we'll have more time to get more information out to the community, so we have more programs coming in to ask them for money. We have a bunch of money to give out.
Great. All right. Any questions from the committee? Any discussion? All right, then I'll entertain a motion to approve Resolution 267.
I'll move.
Moved by Legislator Harmon, second by Legislator McCullough. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Resolution 268, confirming appointment of members to the Ulster County Youth Board. We don't necessarily need to go into all of them. I don't know if there's anything specific to add, but all of the information should be in the packet, and I don't really want to take the time to go through every single member right now, unless anyone has any questions or concerns. Okay. Then I will entertain a motion to adopt 268. Moved by Legislator Corcoran. Seconded by Legislator Collins. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, Resolution 273, approving the execution of a contract for $50,000 entered into by the county with Tay Fisher's Community Cornerstone through the Youth Bureau. And Interim Director McDonald, I'll let you frame this one.
Yes, this is part of the youth team sports funding that we got this year that was new this year. We got $76,000. And we had to disperse that between teams. We were lucky to have a new program come on this year called the Rosendale Swim Team, and they do competitions, so they were able to qualify for some of the other money. Dave Fisher asked for a lot more money than this, but OCFS only allows us to give one particular program up to $50,000 anyway. And I understand 2 years ago the legislature voted on a $50,000 fund for this program as well. It's a very big program, basketball for all. I believe my son went to this program at one point. You know, they try not to turn too many kids down. There's funding for kids and uniforms and coaches and competition. As many of you may know, Tate Fisher is a former Kingston High School standout, superstar basketball player, played for the Harlem Globetrotters and the Varsity. So I just think it's a wonderful program. He does a lot with the kids. He teaches, you know, they learn more than just basketball at these camps. You know, they learn to win, they learn to lose, and be good sports kids. So,
great, good program. Any questions for Interim Director McDonald? Any discussion among the committee? All right, then I'll entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 273. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Great. Thank you so much for being here. Resolution 290, authorizing the chair of the legislature to execute an intermunicipal agreement between the Department of Mental Health and the Dutchess County Department of Behavioral and Community Health through the Department of Health. And Commissioner McDonald, I will defer to you on framing the background on this.
Sure. So this is McDonald.
I did specify MacDonald, so just to be clear,
I checked the spellings. So.
I'm an MC. We're both MC.
You are? Oh, then mine is wrong.
Yeah.
This says MAC. Michael.
So this is an extension of the agreement that we've had with Dutchess County for the past 2 years. The State Office of Mental Health passed a helpline at Dutchess County to act as the call center for the 988 service. And they have been acting in our stead for that for the past 2 years since the implementation of 988.
Any questions from the committee? For Commissioner McDonald? Sorry. As someone with a complicated last name, I really like to get this stuff right. I'll do better. All right, any discussion? All right, then I'll entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 290.
I'll move it.
All right, moved by Legislator Collins, second by Legislator Corcoran. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, Resolution 291, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $3,056, causing the aggregate contract plus amendment amount to be in excess of $50,000, entered by the county with Family of Woodstock, Inc., through the Department of Mental Health. And Commissioner McDonald, if you can frame this one for us.
Sure. So we'll see a few of these coming down the pipe because the Office of Mental Health has redone their structure and how they're allowing for monies to go to specific types of programs. So this is not the Family of Woodstock contract in total that's getting additional money. It's just these different types of services. So it's money they're giving us, and we are willing to take it.
Any questions for the commissioner? Any discussion? All right, then I will entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 291. Moved by Legislator McCullough.
Second.
Seconded by Legislator Harmon. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Resolution 292, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $5,547, causing the aggregate contract plus amendment amount to be in excess of $50,000, entered into by the county with Health Alliance Hospital, Marys Avenue Campus, with the Department of Mental Health. And this is the same increase in OMH?
Correct.
Yep. Okay, so we might not need more background than that, but if anyone has any further questions. All right, any points of discussion? Okay, with that, I will entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 292. All right, moved by Legislator Harmon, seconded by Legislator Collins. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Resolution 293, approving the execution of a contract for $158,015, entered into by the county with Human Services Research Institute through the Department of Mental Health. Commissioner McDonald, if you could give us the background on this one.
Sure. So the legislature charged the department to create an RFP to identify a partner to do behavioral health needs assessment for Ulster County. In having that resolution, we followed the tenets, we put out an RFP, we got back about 3 to 4 respondents, and we chose this person out of our committee.
The hope is that they'll be able to do a comprehensive look at our current system, put it against the background of regional counties our size, expand it out to the nationwide, and then help us to determine where our gaps are, where there may be opportunities for us to be able to come to fill those gaps, and who should fill those gaps. Should it be continued through contracting, or are these places that the county should possibly consider providing services directly? So we're really excited. This is a contract that starts us off, and we're hoping to have some community stakeholder conversations as soon as the ink on the contract is dry.
Wonderful. Any questions for Commissioner McDonald? Yeah, this has been a long time in the works, but it's been a diligent process that I've kind of watched unfold, and I really appreciate it. All right, any points of discussion? Okay, then I'll entertain a motion to adopt 293.
Move. Motion.
All right, moved by Legislator Collins, seconded by Legislator Corcoran. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Right. Resolution number 294, approving the execution of a contract for $494,918 assumed by the county with Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster through the Department of Social Services. And Commissioner Iposi, do you want to give us the background on this?
Sure. This is a program that you have heard about previously, and it's an ongoing program through OTDA that is really been successful in terms of helping with homelessness prevention. So our service provider here, Catholic Charities, is able to identify families and individuals in the community that are struggling to meet their rental obligations. And then in accordance with that scenario, there doesn't necessarily have to be a situation where there's a subject of an eviction proceeding, but if that is the case, they can also entertain an application from that individual or family. And in last year's iteration of this program, we were able to successfully help 33 families and individuals remain in their residential locations. So this is a renewed program as part of the 24-25 budget, and we will continue to, provided this resolution passes, work with Catholic Charities on this program, and we would have until March 31st of 2025 to extend these funds.
Any questions for the commissioner? Yep.
Just one. Is this budget bigger than last year's?
No, it's the exact same.
Okay, Okay. Thank you.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
How much is saved by doing this, right, rather than not filling in that gap? I know we've talked about it before, but.
Right. So let me take a shot at trying to in a way that won't confuse me and confuse everybody else. So let's just consider that one family is able to remain where they're residing, and they are able to continue to meet their rental obligation. So that's a family that then doesn't have to go into emergency housing. So we know that families get placed at shelters or at hotels and motels. And let's just say that the average cost of placing a family in a motel is $110 a night. So that does not end up having to be expended, and that family can remain where they're living and hopefully continue to be in a stable situation. If you multiply that out over 33, families and or individuals, kind of then take a crack at what the savings would be.
Yeah. I thank you. I just feel like every time we should elevate the how it's beneficial in every possible way to do this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But any of the clients repeat?
They are not yet, but they could be.
Okay.
Yeah, they are not yet. And
if they are, will you help them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we will. And again, this was a program that we talked about earlier in the year. You know, and our goal is obviously to exhaust this allocation, utilize all of it. And, you know, we'll serve as many families and individuals as we're able to with this allocation. We'll also give us the opportunity to pay arrears in some cases as well.
Yep, go ahead.
if someone, somebody who needs help again, mm-hmm. and you have other people on the list, is it in order or first come, first serve?
It would be first come, first serve.
Okay. So somebody can get help twice before some. Yeah. Okay.
As long as they're meeting the eligibility requirement.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any discussion on Resolution 294? I will entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 294. Moved by Legislator McCullough, seconded by Legislator Harmon. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
All right. And that's $600,000 a month this year.
Resolution 295, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $72,500 entered by the county with James McGinnis and Associates, Inc. to the Department of Social Services. And switch back, let's see if you want to give us the background on this.
Sure, I'm going to bounce past this Deputy Commissioner Rita Wood, who has a little bit more experience with this particular
this is a company,
program.
It's our software program that we use for our preschool special education services. So kind of like an all-inclusive thing. We get information from the school districts when they approve a preschooler's IEP. We put all the services into it. The providers use it as a mechanism to submit their bills to us electronically, so we don't have to scan write out things. Then it also allows us to electronically submit reimbursement to Medicaid and to the state for our portion of reimbursement and their yearly amount that they charge us.
All right. Any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Any discussion on Resolution 295? All right, and I will entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 295. Moved by Legislator Harmon, seconded by Legislator Collins. All those in favor? Any opposed? All right, we have reached the point of our agenda. I feel like I'm like in the middle of a seder or something. We've reached the point in our agenda where we have a lot of resolutions that are all about the same thing. They mm-hmm. are different service providers for foster care, and there are about 20 of them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different service providers. It is the same service that's being provided by each of the service providers, and I would like, if it is the will of the county, to block these resolutions together. There are 23 of them. Mm-hmm. I will feed you the script for how we block them. Does anyone have an issue with that? And then we can discuss them as a block. Now, the only reason you might have an issue with that is if there was like a specific provider that you had a problem with, because the service itself is the same. Okay. So I would entertain, and you can respond to this by saying so moved, I would entertain a motion to block resolutions 296, 297, 298, 299, 300, 301, 302, 303, 304, 305, 306, 307, 308, 309, 310, 311, 312, 313, 314, 315, 316, 317, and 318.
So moved.
Great, thank you. Can I have a second on that?
Second.
Okay, so now we're going to, is there any discussion on the act of blocking them all together? Okay, so now we are going to move on the action of blocking them all together. All those in favor?
Aye.
Great. Any opposed? Okay, so now they are a block. And before we consider them as a block, I'll let Commissioner Iposi just give us a quick framing of the service that's being provided here.
Sure. Enormously grateful. You're missing it with the block.
So, good for 2 years.
Yeah, that's also another. So these are contracts that we are seeking to enter into with residential treatment facilities where we potentially place children that come into our care and custody that cannot be placed in relative foster care or foster care. And a couple of reasons why we enter into so many contracts with so many different facilities is that this is a very unpredictable kind of circumstance. We never know when a child will potentially come into our custody that has to be placed in a residential treatment facility. Many residential treatment facilities do not have vacancies on an ongoing basis. So when we arrive at having a child who we have to place, we frequently have to make applications to multiple residential treatment facilities so that we can find an appropriate match. It's extremely important that when we are directed to place a child in a residential treatment facility, that we are able to arrive at confirming that placement. If we are not able to do that, we as a county could incur liabilities for not having contracts in place with an adequate number of facilities where we can place a child. I'll also ask Deputy Commissioner Rita Wood to make a few additional comments, but that is essentially an explanation around why so many contracts and why they're so important to have in place.
So I just quickly went through the numbers that we have in foster care today. Caveat, some of these contracts are also school placements, make placements to these agencies. We're responsible for some of those payments. If they're in the summer program, we pay for the summer program and then we get reimbursed again through the school district. So there's some, I don't have those numbers. But for foster care, we currently have 120 children in foster care. 14 of them are in residential placements using these contracts. 2 are in group homes also using these contracts. And there are 6 agencies, 6 of these contracts run what they call therapeutic foster homes, meaning that it's a higher level of foster care they get. They're in a home with foster parents, but they need more 24-hour supervision. The foster parents have more training. There's more responsibility on that part, and they have more case management 24-hour, per se. And we have 31 children in those homes. So out of that 120 kids that we currently have today, 47 children are in one of these programs. I think it's a telling sign to say that we have more in our typical, our traditional foster homes or our relative homes, and that's our intention. Even when they're at this higher level of care, it's our responsibility to keep working towards getting them to a foster home and stepping them down.
Any questions for the commissioner or deputy commissioner? Yep, legislative minority leader Roberts.
Thank you, majority leader. When you say residential treatment center, is that for the entire 120? Is that just an overall term, or is that for the 47 that have special needs?
That's kind of an overall term.
Commissioner McCullough. Do you operate with any other foster care? Therapeutic is only one. I know there's therapeutic is only one.
Do you operate with any other type of foster care?
With therapeutic homes, there's 3 main ones that we work with. Mm-hmm. Abbott House, Astor, Berkshire.
Oh, no. That's therapeutic only. I know there's others out there. You got medical foster care and there's other ones.
We don't have.
You only deal with therapeutic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Any discussion? All right, then I will entertain a motion to adopt this block of resolutions. All right, moved by Legislator McCullough, seconded by Legislator Harmon. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Great. Resolution, all right, so moving on to resolutions for legislators. Resolution 264, providing ARPA funding for implementation of state-mandated requirements to have AED equipment at camps and youth sports programs in Ulster County through the ARPA Division, Department of Finance, Division of Recovery and Resilience. Deputy Chair Lopez, you want to frame the...
Sure. Yeah, it's... It's pretty self-explanatory. It basically tells you what it's about in the title. In January, the state passed legislation that made it mandatory to have these defibrillator devices at camps and sporting events for kids. So, in compliance with that mandate, Joe and I have put in this resolution to use ARPA funds for it. To provide for the devices.
And the mandate is on the programs themselves, or is the mandate on the county?
The mandate is on, I believe it's on the county.
Yeah, I did a little bit of My understanding before hearing your explanation, which I mean, either could be true, and I would obviously think it's a great idea. My understanding is the mandate is on the sports programs, and we're helping them fulfill the mandate.
That's my understanding too.
Yeah.
That's probably correct.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that nevertheless, it's going to a great cause. So yeah, and I had shared in ARPA a little bit about me that I was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is an inherent enlarged heart that causes electrical problems and is the number one cause of sudden cardiac death with children. So if you hear about an athlete that goes into cardiac arrest on the basketball court, it's most likely they have this HCM and it went undetected. Now, although COVID isn't causing an increase in this HCM, it's exacerbated the effects and the symptoms of it. Mm. So it's been reported, but yeah, it usually doesn't get a lot of press unless it's a high profile person. But ultimately, with one of these defibrillators being at every event, camps and sporting events, it's kind of a no-brainer to be able to save a life if need be.
Yeah, we probably all heard stories about student athletes, youth athletes having, collapsing during a practice, and it's horrifying. So if we could just prevent one, I think it would be a huge thing. Legislator Collins.
I think this is a great program. How do the camps know that this is available? Are we going to let them find out some of it? I know there's a ton of camps. And how do they know?
Well, we definitely put out a press release, and there's ways to reach out to the organization.
Camps have to be approved by it. It's actually one of the interesting things that our county Department of Health has a responsibility to do, which is approving camps. So we actually do already have a direct relationship. So it's actually an easier problem to solve than some of the others we've been trying to solve.
And through the health department, I'm sure.
Through the health department, yeah, because they have to go to the health department for approvals. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Deputy Executive Contreras.
On that point, there is, so the health department, we're supportive of this resolution. I think it's a process. The health department licenses summer camps. I don't think that they license the other, the sports camps. So in terms of implementation, we were thinking it would be good, ideal to go through a nonprofit to disperse the funds. Otherwise, we would have to get into contracts with a lot of, for small amounts of money with a lot of different organizations, which would be hard for them, hard for us. So that would be our preference. And then also, we're just wondering if we could, if there was a list or a number of camps that was used for the estimate, because the number of camps that we have approved for the health department is only like 60 or so.
It's different. The numbers are different. Yeah, I would have to reach out to Joe to find exactly how he got those numbers. But yeah, I don't have an objection to go through a not for profit in order to disperse. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If that'll be a better way to do it, an easier way to do it.
Cool. Any other discussions? Yep, Minority Leader Roberts.
If we decide to go through a nonprofit, would that have to be a follow-up resolution next month?
Well, if the disbursement is going to the nonprofit, then it would have to. Then definitely the whole thing is going to have to
come.
If just the service contract is going to them,
yeah.
Which I don't know if that's even possible.
Yeah, we'll have to work all that out. But that's just a flag on the implementation, because that's a lot of, as you all know, contracting is a cumbersome process. And if we're talking contracts for like less than $2,000 and a lot of them, it'll be.
Any other questions or comments, discussion?
All right, then I'll entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 264. Moved by Legislator Harmon, seconded by Legislator Collins. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, great. Resolution 265, providing ARPA funding for a commissary kitchen through the ARPA Division, Department of Finance, Division of Recovery and Resilience. And I am one of the sponsors here, so I'll frame this. So when we first started working on distributing or prioritizing the distribution of ARPA funding, one, and this is in the backup, there was a, we did a lot of work to prioritize, and the ARPA committee did a lot of work to prioritize different programs that we might fund. And one that ranked very, very high, I think it was the second most highly ranked, was funding for a commissary kitchen. There are a lot of small food manufacturers, food vendors, food trucks. You know, I have, especially with real estate the way that it is, like, you know, just as an example, and this is not, this happened since that this idea came, but a beloved restaurant in my district has lost their lease because their building was purchased by a big landlord that would rather it be empty. And so they want to continue their business, but they just can't afford the commercial rent. And obviously there are very few protections for commercial tenants. And so they want to continue their business doing food trucks and pop-ups and things like that. And this type of commissary kitchen would be able to help businesses like that, of which there are really many in this community. And so it's kind of one of those last big initiatives from that original ARPA ranking that we haven't moved forward with. And it happens that there is a proposal to include a commissary kitchen in the RUPCO supportive housing development that is rehabbing the old Quality Inn. It is the space that was the Rudigan Steakhouse that's, you know, by the Ford dealership. And so that space has been empty. It's like right by the throughway. It's got plenty of space if like there was like a food truck or loading dock that they needed to get access to. I don't know that there's a loading dock, but there is. There, Peter and I went over there and took a look at it, and it just seems like a great program. You know, RUPCO is working to figure out, you know, what they can include as they're piecing together all the pieces of funding to make that happen. And I think for the county to be able to fund the commissary kitchen component of it would be a huge win. It would help us fulfill that initiative that we ranked very highly in the original ARPA rankings, and I hope that you all will consider it. I think it could be a really good way to kind of a one-time you know, a one-time expense that would pay dividends over time to the food businesses in our community. Yep, Legislator Collins.
Yeah, answered in the previous meeting, but just to be clear, it will be operated by RUPCO, whoever they have doing it.
Yeah.
And once we do the setup, it's no more costs on our.
Yeah, it's a capital expense. It's a one-time capital expense for us. There's not like an operational burden, which is the right way to think about ARPA money. Yeah, in my view, yeah. Any other questions or concerns?
It's a great idea.
Great. All right, well, then I would entertain a motion to adopt it.
I will move.
All right, moved by Legislator Harmon, seconded by Legislator McCullough. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Pages were sticking together. Resolution 263, exercising Ulster County's termination rights under Article 30 of a contract between the County of Ulster and Samadhi Center, Inc. And Minority Leader Roberts, the floor is yours.
Thank you again, Mr. Majority Leader. This contract right here, I'll give you a little brief history. We awarded the contract to Samadhi back last year around this time frame. It was for $700,000 or around about that much money. Samadhi had spent about approximately $300,000. My numbers are probably off a little bit. There's approximately $400,000 that is unspent money. I don't want to get into the whole history of this, but in December, the county comptroller flagged Samadhi for a variety of reasons and has not approved the December bill. is not paying it. Somadi has not sent in any more bills for this year up until June. So that's 5 months of billing that they haven't submitted. It's obvious that Somadi is self-sustaining without this funding, and that original, what's left of the $700,000, something around $400,000, is in a county fund dedicated to opioid abuse treatments. We need to, as I put in a resolution that was defeated last month, we need to get that money that's out there working for the people that need it the most, the victims of drug abuse, their families. That money could be going a long way. Again, this, and it doesn't, once that money's out there, it doesn't exclude Somadi from bidding on that new money, nor does this resolution have anything that would affect any types of drug treatment, including harm reduction. And all I ask, you know, it doesn't do any good in postponing this resolution, is a courtesy of an up or down vote, Mr. Chair.
This is a good opportunity for us to hear from the county executive's team on where things are at with Somadi. I know that the last time we met, they were approaching their state certification. I believe that's been approved. So maybe you can just give us an update. And if there's anything, the comptroller's not here, but I would, I don't know where they're at with their work with Somadi to get the financials sorted out.
So as you said, last time we met, we were waiting to make sure, waiting on the outcome of the approval process from the State Office of Addiction Supports and Services. They did, Somadi did get that license approval. So at that point, we felt comfortable moving forward with a contract amendment for 2024. So we have sent that contract amendment to Somadi. We haven't heard back yet at this point, but that's been transmitted to them. We've been having this conversation for a few months. We don't support discontinuing the contract with them. We believe that they are providing an important service. I think sort of Juanita's presentation earlier illustrated some of the benefit, which is that we are seeing less reported overdoses, which means that the current system of services that we have in the county is helping either decrease overdoses or decrease the need for people who are experiencing overdose to call 911 to get help because the services are out there. So that's where we're at this point. I don't know if there's anyone else there. No.
Yes,
Robert. Thank you again. 2 months ago, we were told that the amendment to the Somadi contract was signed in May or June of 2023, and now we're just told that the amendment was put in place after the certification was complete. You know, and congratulations on the certification. Unfortunately, and you're all welcome to have conversations with the comptroller's office, same as I have. And they have not met the financial threshold to get, you know, awarded money through this contract for her to find it fit to pay them. So we're at a bypass here that, as of right now, they're not going to get paid. There's nothing we could do to pay them, or they could do to get paid, according to the comptroller. So we're at a bypass on what direction we're going to go. Are we going to wait for them to get their financial house in order, which may never happen, or are we going to move on and get this money out in the street and help kids that need it, and you know adults and that are really could use it?
So my understanding, and just to clarify, and I'll go to Deputy Executive if what I'm about to say is not correct, but their contract time was extended by a communication between the procurement office and the vendor. So that was what happened last year. What is happening now that the state certification has been approved is a formal contract amendment that would extend more than just the time. So that's one thing I want to clarify. and because it wasn't a contract amendment that happened last year. It was just an extension of the time based on a communication between procurement, our procurement office and Somati. That's one. And the second thing is, just to be clear, it is my understanding, and correct me again if I'm wrong, that Somati continues to provide this service. So the framing of this as a gap in service not being provided because of the financials is inaccurate. They are continuing to provide the service. They're just not getting paid for it. And they seem confident enough that they will get their financial situation sorted out, that they will continue to provide this important service that we seem to all agree is an important service that they're providing. And so it's not as though this service isn't being provided currently, and this money, while the money is sitting there, the money that the service that the money is intended for, is allocated for, is being fulfilled. It's not as though there's now a gap in these services being provided. Is that correct, Deputy Executive?
Yes, that's correct. And that is the service that we RFP'd for, that they were the only ones who proposed. Nobody else proposed that service. It's been approved by the state in the first place, and then the expansion was also approved by the state recently. So that's the service that they're currently providing.
Yep. So I'm going to go to a minority leader, and then I want to start pulling some other folks into the conversation.
Thank you. And I agree with what you said, Mr. Chairman, that, you know, they are providing the service. Hopefully I didn't mislead anybody saying that they're not providing it, because that wasn't my intention. They are providing a service, and they're not getting reimbursed as of right now by the county. And to my knowledge, my conversations, it doesn't appear that they're going to be reimbursed. The purpose of this is to exercise a right to terminate it so we can get that remaining opioid funding to other outlets that can provide a duplicate service, because God knows we do need it.
So I'm going to go to Legislator Harmon, followed by McCullough and Collins.
My question is, for whoever can answer, I guess, is there any reason we can't find another provider, if possible, while continuing what we have, so that rather than creating a chasm, we've created an option?
I'll defer to Deputy Executive Concurris to answer that.
So, Tara, please step in to elaborate, but these services that are being provided are licensed services. And so that is a very long and robust process. That's what the money just got approved. So if we were to try to find another provider right now, firstly, I don't know if we would be able to find one. And secondly, they'd have to start from square one to go through the licensing. So that would create a gap.
That's
absolutely true. Just so that you guys can know for the front of your mind right now, that what we were looking for was to be able to fund their expansion before they have the ability to bill for the services and then be able to be sustaining on their own. It was not something that we were going to continue to do ongoing. We wanted them to have the ability to build the expanded services, and it meant building out the space so that they could have more room, a larger waiting room. All of those things were done, but they just got the license. Medicaid allows for you to backbill for, I think, up to 90 days, and they're not going to be able to bill for the expanded services while this is just going through. So this money was really supposed to be supporting them. They're choosing not to put in the invoices based on the idea that the comptroller's made it clear that for right now she's not willing to pay the bill. But they continue to provide the service. They continue to have a medical biller. They continue to have a chief medical officer. They continue to have a CASAC that this was paying for. So in order for, and I just want to reiterate what Joanna says, in order for you to do an OASIS license, they would have to find another provider that has the ability to meet the criteria to have a license, put in an application, and then the application process takes anywhere from 4 to 6 months, which means that we wouldn't be getting anything.
But during that time, there would be a gap. If they approved this resolution, this resolution would create a gap in service. Okay, thank you. I've got Legislator McCullough and then Collins.
My 9-to-5 is in child welfare, which is a nonprofit. We're always audited. And my point I want to make is that somebody's being audited or audited. The auditors will come up with findings, give you recommendations, and all they have to do is do a corrective action plan. And my advice to them would be to get a fiscal person, part-time, full-time, because a lot of times, a lot of these programs, you have program people trying to do fiscal stuff, and they don't really know. And in this case, I think the social work part of a person that wants to help, helps without thinking fiscally, maybe thinking fiscally first. So I don't think we should punish them. Let the auditors do what they have to do. Let them come up with the correct action plan and continue to do the work that they want. Thank you.
Legislator Collins.
A lot of what I was going to say has been said already. If we don't continue this contract, we'll lose the services for 6 months, whatever, however long it takes someone else to get the state certification. Somadi was the only one who replied to the RFP in the first place. What's going to make us think someone else is going to be able to reply to this RFP? I have every confidence that Somadi will get an audited 2023 results very shortly. The 2022 was conditionally accepted. Our controller was being very, very picky. It was an accepted audit, conditionally accepted audit. She was very picky about it. This coming audit, I expect to be clean. We have continually funded other nonprofits that have not even filed 990, whether or not it was audited. We've continually funded them, and we have had no issues with that. So what is it about Somadi that is different than any other nonprofit that we funded for years, about 990s? It's not about the financials. It's something else.
Minority Leader Roberts.
Yeah, thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to say that I have seen the RFP, and there has been at least 8 other businesses that applied for it back last year. It's public knowledge. Anybody could take a look at them. I could email you the list if you want. I don't know if they're OASIS certified, but you know, to be certified or have a new license, apparently that's something new that Somadi has. You know, they didn't have it all last year when they were receiving county money. They're over on Broadway, 361 or whatever the address number is, and they're using part of the money to pay us back the rent. So we're giving them money to pay us back on the rent, something like $6,000 a month. And their violations aren't small. There is up to $55,000 in cash withdrawals that they cannot explain other than they gave hotel room money for hotel rooms and tents to people in distress, which I think any one of us would find that a stretch. So I mean, you're talking $55,000 in missing money, among other things. You guys are all have the county comptroller's phone number. You're all privy to the same information I am, so do your research on that.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Deputy Executive Contreras, and then I would like to move us forward to vote on this.
Yes, I just want to clarify, because I don't want what I said to be misconstrued. There were 12 organizations that applied to the RFP. Somadi was the only one. It was a very broad RFP. We asked anyone to submit proposals related to prevention, technology, treatment, and one other
housing.
Okay, so Somadi's proposal was the only one that proposed an expanded outpatient treatment clinic. That's what I was saying.
All right. I, as I often am, inclined to defer to the sponsor of the legislation, whether a postponement or a up or down vote is the preferred path. That said, as chair of the committee, I don't want to tip my finger on the scale, so if someone wanted to make a postponement, of course, would entertain it. However, my recommendation would be to defer to the sponsor, and the way that that would go down is someone on the committee would make a motion to adopt it and vote on it. All right, there's a motion.
Second.
There's a motion and a second, so that's a live motion. Any further discussion on the motion before I call the question? All those in favor?
Aye.
And those opposed? So I'm counting 2-4.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the courtesy.
Thank you, Minority Leader Roberts. We appreciate it, and I appreciate the conversation that we're having here.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we don't have new business. The one piece of old business that I'll mention is just that Resolution 259, which we discussed previously, has been withdrawn. That was establishing a policy to prohibit addiction recovery and harm reduction services at facilities where children's services were offered. That's been withdrawn by the sponsors, which is why it's no longer for us. So. All right. I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion.
All right. Moved by Colin, moved by Corcoran, second by, who seconded that, Colin?
Second.
Second by Lopez. Wonderful.
Third by McCullough.
All those in favor.
Aye.
Great.